papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project gives you a window into what's going on in the news media and decision-making in newsrooms and some commentary on what's going on in the media issues of the day. I am Rex Smith, former editor of the Times Union, here with some other veteran journalists. We have Judy Patrick, the former editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady. How do?
Good day.
Good day. Good day, as they say. Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy.
Good day, mate.
Thank you very kindly. And our former publisher, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman and affiliated publications in Kingston, New York, that would be Ira Fussfeld.
Hello, Rex and everybody. Good to be back.
Hello out there in Radioland. So we have several things to talk about today, covering demonstrations, covering the Trump trial and all of the affiliated stuff. And the business of journalism, there are a couple of things on that that we need to talk about. So let's see what we can do. First off, those demonstrations, you know, the demonstrations that are now rocking campuses across the country, of course, are newsworthy because of the impact that they may have on political life, on decision making in America, and the potential for violence. It's not that it's not newsworthy, but is the coverage appropriate? Are we doing a good enough job with this, or do we have some concerns? Is that a loaded question, Judy?
Yeah, well, yes. but I think it's a good question because I have found the coverage to be over the top. I think it's breathless. I think it exaggerates what's happening. From a purely citizen perspective, I found it refreshing that this young generation has enough spunk to get out there and protest something that they believe in. We can talk about issues of free speech and campus protests, but the coverage, especially on cable news, has
been nonstop. That's what I was going to ask you. Do you limit cable news?
There are a lot of things to cover in the world, but to cover this once every 15 minutes is too much.
You think so, Ira?
Yeah, without a doubt. The problem with cable news, as I've often said here, is they've got 24 hours a day to fill, and you wind up having to, by necessity, sewing stuff for more time than it deserves in the guise that it's breaking news, which is another bugaboo of mine, the use of the phrase breaking news after it's been in news for 4 days. But yeah, without question, that huge number of people on individual campuses, the only thing that concerns me about these protests as opposed to any number of other college protests is that it is said there is concern for Jewish student safety. That's a new element, I believe, to college protests. But college protests historically have been part of the fabric of academia, and they're a good thing and shouldn't be treated like World War III.
Yet, Barbara, what do we do when you have the Speaker of the House going to a prominent Ivy League campus? You have to cover him, right? You have to be there.
You do have to cover that, but go back to the premise of your introduction to this part of the discussion when you said that these protests are, quote, rocking campuses across America.
Rex.
Well, University of Texas at Austin, Yale, Harvard, and Columbia, of course, but California,
so there are protests
Humboldt.
Of various sizes happening at places around the country. It's definitely true. But it's not a big disaster as we would make it. As Rex, didn't you say that you were down in the city?
I was there,
actually. Saw it with your own eyes.
In between this show and last week's show, I spent 3 days on the Columbia campus at the Journalism School, which is, by the way, right next to where the demonstrators had pitched their tents. They had been moved into a section of the quad. So I would say it was very loud on one side of the journalism building. But noteworthy that the New York Times story on one of the days that I was there said scores of demonstrators, which is accurate. There were probably 60 demonstrators, yet there
That's
were
not four even
four stories.
Score.
Yeah, there was not even four score, but there were four stories in the Times that day, which does seem a bit overblown, don't you think, for what was actually going on?
Yes, and I think when students are demonstrating, which is a good thing to show action, civil disobedience comes with consequences, and those who are protesting need to be prepared, and perhaps they are, as part of their protests, as part of their civil disobedience. They might get arrested. They might get shut down. that's part of the process. One of the things that concerns me greatly is mischaracterizing what's happening on campuses in a way to denigrate intellectual debate on college campuses. They were having trouble separating anti-Semitism from legitimate protests about Gaza.
Valid concern, I think. Although when you have the Jewish rabbi of Columbia saying to Jewish students, sadly, I think you should stay in your dorms, it occurs to me that there is an effort to manipulate the process there even. We are all subject to second-guessing in these decisions when we decide, well, you have to cover the Speaker of the House, but the Speaker is going there, I am convinced, with the intent of driving a wedge that establishes the college scene, the intellectual scene of the Democrats, as being alien from the anti-intellectual Republican base that is MAGA Republicanism these days.
That's what I meant to say.
Yeah. You know, it should also be noted some reporters had difficulty covering these protests because the obstacles were put in place by the protesters themselves. I think the people at the Columbia School of Journalism helped facilitate access to the protest by mainstream news media. So
I didn't realize that had been reported. I thought that was secret.
I think that was on social media. So
Interesting. Yes, that is true. Because the journalism school was very upset that the university had tried to shut down access, right?
Well, this coverage is also an illustration of one of the foibles of journalism. When you send reporters out to talk to people at the scene, and it could be the scene of a disaster, of a campaign, of a protest, the reporters are picking and choosing who to talk to. And sometimes it's who's accessible, who looks like they're going to give me a good quote, who's willing to talk to me, and not necessarily truly representative of a more thoughtful response. And that's a challenge for reporters that I think we don't always succeed at achieving.
I just don't think that there is a frame of reference that's adequately been described to listeners and to readers and viewers as to what college campuses are all about and what the college career is all about and what is the history of college protests. These are far from the first protests on a campus or multiple campuses. It's part of the growth of the students as they're feeling their way and they're getting involved with civic and international issues and expressing an opinion. And who knows, in 10 or 20 years, the hundreds of protesters who are protesting today may look back on this and say, boy, what was I thinking? But whatever it was, it's all part of the growth of people through academia. And as I said before, except for the potential threat for violence and fears for safety, and we don't know if those are really threats or not, this is business as usual, in my view, on college campuses. And I encourage this kind of thing because I know I grew up in college learning these things, whether I was a protester or an observer. And I was always an observer, as I still am today. But it's important to your growth. And this is what college is supposed to provide beyond what row you're sitting on in lecture hall.
The difficulty, too, though, is when you have some of these things that are happening that may be precursors to further action. You want to be the journalist who's on top of the story. There are a lot of notions that, well, this is 1968, and remember how protests so disrupted the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 68 that it set the stage for the Democrats to be depicted as against law and order by the Nixon campaign. Some of us are old enough to remember that.
And that could happen again at this convention, which parenthetically is also going to be in Chicago this year.
Exactly. So you want to be cognizant of that in your coverage. It's a difficult balancing act, I think, for the people who call the shots in America's newsrooms to figure out what is fair and accurate coverage of what's going on and what is overplaying or playing into the hands of people who try to use what's going on for political ends. Elise Stefanik, the congresswoman from part of upstate New York, clearly has the intent of attempting to denigrate American higher education. She's a product of Harvard and is now an anti-Harvard person, I think, again, for her political ends in support of Donald Trump. But yet it's not inappropriate to cover what a member of Congress says and does with these things. It's just a hard balancing act for journalists, I think.
The question is whether to make it a headline or to bury it in the 10th graph.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people who are not journalists who haven't had to make these decisions as reporters or as editors about how to play a story or how to structure a story don't appreciate how those judgments are made thoughtfully and carefully, usually. Although I will say that sometimes in the newsroom, we get so accustomed to doing it that we overlook the power that lies in the hands of journalists in making these assessments, which is why it's great to have multiple bits of coverage. But when I came out of the subway at the Columbia University campus at 116th and Broadway, there were demonstrators in the streets, New York City police officers guiding traffic around. And there were TV cameras and notebooks out everywhere because it was right around the early evening newscasts. And, of course, the street protests ended as soon as the newscasts were over.
Were you asked for ID or something to get on campus?
Well, the campus had only one gate open, and yes, it was quite tightly controlled to get into the campus, which is probably why there are only scores of protesters on the campus.
Well, one of the allegations is that there have been outside agitators who have been coming in, and I didn't know how easy it was for an outside agitator to get there.
Yeah, the first night that there were encampments, apparently that was so. And then in the streets, I'm sure there were outsiders. But that's why the university needed to establish some control. So, you know, the educational mission of the schools is effective. Because they can't conduct in-person classes. I don't see how they're going to do a graduation ceremony. All right, we're at the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith here with Judy Patrick, Barbara Lombardo, and Ira Fussfeld. And we invite your comments, media@wamc.org. media@wamc.org is who we are. Speaking of cameras being present and that affecting things, we are witnessing the first trial of a former United States president, that going on in the criminal courtroom in Manhattan, the state Supreme Court, which does not allow cameras in the courtroom under New York state law, except in very specific circumstances. What's the impact of that? What would cameras do if we had them in the courtroom? Would that be good, or would that be playing to the cameras again?
Well, the argument historically about cameras in courtrooms for those who don't want cameras in courts is that it would create a circus-like atmosphere and all the principals would be playing up to the camera. The other side of that, again, is why not show what is essentially an open courtroom to people who could not get or unable to get into the courtroom? There are, in fact, cameras in the courtroom in this case because they're using it on a closed circuit to show the overflow press in another room what's been going on. I've been arguing this for so long, I almost forget where to start. You go to the Supreme Court where it's the same thing. They're allowing audio coverage of their cases, but not cameras. It's an anachronistic policy, and it ought to change because the public is not being well served when it doesn't have the opportunity to see these trials.
I agree with you, Ira. The technology exists. We ought to be using it, period. It's an open trial. It's a public trial. The public can see it. Yes, there are the problems of whether attorneys or other people are going to play to the cameras or defendants. What are you going to zoom in on or focus on as a camera person? And you know, will it create that circus-like atmosphere? I'm willing to take that risk to make these trials public.
It's been a horrible disservice to the public. Let's just admit it. New York is one of only two states in the entire nation that don't allow audiovisual coverage of court proceedings. We are denied access. We would know, for example, whether we could decide for ourselves whether or not Donald Trump fell asleep.
Exactly.
What he says and does. Why is this a secret? There was a State Bar Association had a program back in March that I listened in on about people debating the pros and cons of allowing cameras in the court, because there is a law proposed in the state legislature at this point that would allow that to happen. People who represent the defendants tend to be against this because they say it's going to be prejudicial to their clients. It has not proven to be the case anywhere in the nation. And New York, especially in this case, maybe this case will prompt the New York State Legislature to finally do what it should have done 50 years ago and pass this legislation.
And the technology is such today that the cameras are unobtrusive. You don't even have to have somebody operating the camera, and you could have one the size of a flashlight as a camera.
And we're worried about a circus-like atmosphere. Talk about a circus-like atmosphere now. And in this scenario now, what I have to do is listen to Jake Tapper repeat what whoever's in the courtroom has relayed to him, and what it produces is a jumbled, discombobulated string of comments that lack the context of actually watching the court proceeding take place.
And so what the cameras do pick up is Donald Trump outside the courtroom doing his press conference, his campaign from Manhattan, and that is, of course, picked up and broadcast live by Fox.
And by MSNBC and by CNN, and I think that should stop as well.
And so we are really at a disservice, but you say 50 years ago, that's accurately true. There were trials of this, and that is attempts to assess whether cameras in the courtroom would be problematic. There were three separate state commissions that looked into this back during the administration of Mario Cuomo. That's how long ago it was. Maybe one was even during Hugh Carey's administration. and they all came to the conclusion that cameras in the courtroom would be beneficial for the administration of justice, not detrimental. But it didn't happen. Because, as you say, the Trial Lawyers Association, which is a powerful political force, which used to include the Assembly Speaker Shelley Silver as a member, stopped it. And that remains the case today.
I wrote many an editorial in support of this. I'm sure the Kingston paper
I can't remember how long ago it was.
Oh, yeah.
It was a long time.
Yep. Me too.
The legislators don't want it.
You will see video coverage of sentencings, for example, or victim impact statements, because that's law. But what we're saying at this point, we need to see is the actual trial take place.
Right.
We never would show the jury. That camera would not be on the jury. Probably be a fixed camera. There would be efforts made to protect witnesses who needed special protection. All those things can be dealt with and have been dealt with in other states.
And this is more important than just showing whether Dozing Don had indeed dozed off.
Dozing Don. That's much better than Sleepy Joe. You got the alliteration.
Thank you.
Nobody's ever fallen asleep while listening to this program.
Not on camera.
That's the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Ira Fussfeld, Barbara Lombardo, and Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. Thank you for joining us. We're going to talk now a little bit about efforts to preserve journalism so that you can get to the stories you want to see. It is said that New York has done something historic. Now, of course, that's said in coverage by the media, and it is something involving the media. But New York has become the first state in the nation to incentivize hiring and retaining local journalists by enacting a tax credit. It will give local radio and television stations and newspapers a payroll tax credit to incentivize the hiring of more reporters, up to a total of, isn't it, $300,000 a year at no more than $50,000 per individual hired in tax credits.
For a three-year experiment.
So it's a $30 million a year effort, which is basically a drop in the bucket for a state that has what is the size of the state budget? 30-some billion. So there is no great impact on taxpayers here, but it is especially designed businesses with fewer than 100 employees and those with more than 100 employees. So that's to ensure that really hyper-local independent news organizations will have a shot at this. But the downside is this becomes, in effect, a state subsidy of the media. And is that appropriate?
Well, I've said, yes, it is inappropriate for the longest amount of time on this program. And we've always talked about it, particularly in relationship to this radio station and whether or not it was going to get state funds. So I'm not crazy about the idea. On the other hand, I think it's very smart the way this has been dealt out. You're not really writing a check to anybody, but you're giving them a tax break. The question in my mind is, how effective is this going to be? I think that smaller publications are perhaps more likely to and privately owned companies, to the extent that there are many left, are going to take advantage of it. At least they'll dip their toes in the water. I'm not sure this is going to move large corporations that are more concerned with the bottom line.
Well, to that end, should we be subsidizing the newspapers that are owned by hedge funds that are simply gutting them to get advertising?
I think you should if in fact the hedge funds do what the law is supposed to do, which is hire more reporters. I'm not convinced that they're going to move the needle on that.
So my organization, New York Press Association, we represent newspapers across the state, many family-owned small local newspapers. And then the organization has been in support of this. But when you talk to editors, the people in the actual newsroom, it is a little tough because it's something that we have always resisted. I applaud and I'm gratified by the idea that people have appreciated that local news is important, and the legislature has stepped forward with this bill to at least provide some symbolic support for it. The measure requires $4 million to be used to hire new journalists. The $15 million payroll tax credit is to sustain local journalism, so they could essentially spend it on anything they wanted to sustain the local news operation. That could be any number of ways. What I would encourage and what I would like to see is for us as a newspaper industry to step forth and say, yep, you've done this for us. This is what we can do for you in terms of local reporting. We think having reporters, more reporters out in the field is important, and that's what we're going to do. I also would encourage us as an industry to look at ourselves as we proceed, as we go forward, and see how did this money get spent and what were the positive changes that happened because we received these tax credits.
Well, who's going to monitor that? I think that's a legitimate question that needs to be asked and answered. But is it going to be government, bureaucracy, figuring out how to get the answers? Or could the New York Press Association step up in some form to assess how this is being used, help its member organizations make use of it, and then assess later on how they did? And then you decide what you want to do with that information.
The regulations haven't been written about how this is going to be actually enacted, I think. And I think it's an exciting step.
Well, journalists are good at checking this kind of thing. I think we ought to have journalists taking a look at this. Stay on top of it.
Journalists are bad at math.
But
let me just plot something out here. Tell me where I'm wrong. There was a regional publisher quoted in the Times Union as saying he was very pleased with this and he's going to hire 7 people. Well, that's great. That's what the law is intended to do. But how is he going to measure his success? In other words, for all of the reasons that we all agree that we wish we had more reporters, I don't think any of us in this day and age, with all the competition and technology and for advertising and readers, are convinced that we can ever turn back the clock. And a newspaper that has lost a lot of circulation and has lost a lot of reporters, if you add to those reporters, is it in fact going to mean more circulation? We don't know, but I would say the trend is no, it won't, because we're going the wrong direction. And not because people say to themselves, oh, there's not enough coverage, but because the publication is anachronistic.
Well, now circulation, I hope you're not using that as the metric, because circulation is, you know, print is an anachronism indeed. It's eyeballs. It is basically consumers. So you're looking at how many people are actually being reached by content, not just circulation, right? Because, I mean, newspaper publishers care about print only as a means of getting revenue for advertising, obviously, because the print products are so inferior these days.
Let's say a reporter's $100,000
expense. Oh, man, wow. What world are you in?
All right, let's say 50,000. That's closer to the ballpark.
Plus benefits.
All right, so a reporter is a $50,000 hire. Of that $50,000, the publication is going to receive $25,000 in tax credit, but it is still going to be spending money that it was not currently spending. And the question is it going to be a return on the investment? And my answer is, I'm not so certain that there can be, even if you added 40 reporters, because people are not reading you as much as they used to, digitally or in print. Yes, more people are reading digital than print, but the collective revenue is not, I don't believe, going to be sufficient enough to support this.
So here's another approach. Claudia Tenney, Congresswoman from Central New York.
I had to look her up because she said she used to run a newspaper.
A shopper.
She cared so much about it that she sold it. Anyway, back to you, Rex.
What is she proposing?
She has a bill in Congress that would do tax credits for restaurants, grocery stores, and other small businesses that advertise in local news, as well as a small refundable tax credit for news organizations. That has 40 co-sponsors in the House, but it hasn't even gotten a hearing in Ways and Means, so I think that's not going to get anywhere.
Sometimes we editors, we get on a high horse and we think, oh, you know, we don't want to get any government subsidies, but we forget that we were well subsidized for scores of years by the Postal Department, which helped deliver our newspaper back in the days of...
And what about legal advertising?
We still are, right?
By the requirement that there be advertising of government entities when they're going to let a contract or anything. What do you think about the California approach, which is to force big tech to pay for news? Now, that's happened in Australia, it's happened in Canada, but it would basically require big firms like Google and Meta, which own Facebook and Instagram, to pay news publishers each time they display a piece of their article or show links to them in the search results and social media. Is that a better approach?
I mean, I don't think that's a good approach, especially for local news, because if you ever do a Google search for an Albany, New York store, you're not going to find a small local newspaper at the top of the list.
Well, you might. My former paper in Kingston, we experienced it both ways. I can recall vividly, we ran a small item about the singer Art Garfunkel being pulled over and arrested for smoking pot. Mm-hmm. The amount of hits that we got on that story, and we didn't play it up like it was a giant story, incredible how they were able to find us.
There's a related concern to this, though. I think in theory it makes sense to have Google, Facebook paying the news generators for the news that they are stealing, presenting at no cost to themselves.
Uh-huh.
But the danger then is when Google turns around and closes access to the information that
we have come to rely on as part of using the internet.
Which they have done in California. Google now has blocked news links for California-based news organizations from showing up in search results. So if you're in California and you Google something going on in San Francisco, you're not going to get the San Francisco Chronicle.
Happening in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Same things happen in Canada, right? So these tech giants are deciding we're not going to be the dependable source for everything on these questions as you ask. I think that's ultimately self-defeating for Google, because if they want to be the place people turn for information, they have to be basically neutral about who they turn information to.
You know, and Facebook seems to have ratcheted down their logarithm to displaying any kind of news, especially political news. I see next to none in my feed, and any time I post a story about politics, about something happening in the world, I never see it in...
Well, those posts are mystery to me. In my feed, I will see news stories come up that you can see underneath the headline. It says how old the story is. Why are they running stories as fresh on the top of the list that were 3 days old? I don't understand what that is all about.
Well, on what we don't understand is the point we have to stop, because we are out of time. You know,
we need a lot of time to
say
what we
don't understand. We'll get it figured out. We'll figure it out for next week.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Okay, come back next week, folks, and you won't miss it. Ira Fussfeld, Barbara Lombardo, and Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith, with gratitude to our producer, Dave Gustina, and to you folks for joining us once again this week on The Media Project.
Movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a...
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Substack columnist of the Upstate American, Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former editor of the Daily Gazette and vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association, Barbara Lombardo, the former editor of the Saratogian and a journalism professor at the University at Albany, and Ira Fussfeld, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.